Last year, we welcomed Jim Forrest to Augustana and then to Edmonton. He delivered the Augustana Distinguished Lecture on Fear, the Root of War, and again in Edmonton on Love Your Enemy as Yourself, themes that are at the heart of human dignity, at the heart of the human struggle, and which present to us some of the great challenges we face in our fragile world. Early in 2007, some of you were here, we had the Roddy Forum on Religion and Public Life with Ian Benson, speaking on the theme, Living Together with Disagreement, Pluralism, the Secular, and Fair Treatment of Beliefs in Canada Today. And we took that forum to Calgary, following our time here at the Faith and Life Center. Jim Forrest led us to consider how we might live free of fear, live with the capacity to discipline our natural responses, and thus able to draw life from death. Ian Benson opened up the many and varied questions about the shape of human rights and Canadian law, the limits and the gifts of the current shape of human rights legislation. And this evening, I'm delighted that we're able to welcome Clint Curl to bring an international perspective to these compelling themes in his lecture, Rethinking the Enlightenment, New Directions for International Human Rights. When I first learned about the Enlightenment probably at my father's knee when the United Nations was formed and the Declaration was launched, I had a wonderful flashback to that moment a couple hours ago. I began to rethink the Enlightenment. I have not gotten all that far. But I'm delighted Clint has come because he is, in his book, Humanité, John Humphrey's alternative account of human rights, has begun to prepare the way for the second generation of this most precious, I think, great gift of the 20th century, human rights, which is a curb to that great danger of the divine right of the majority. Dr. Curl holds degrees in theology, legal studies, and a PhD in political science. His father, doctor, was Peter Emberley, colleague of mine at Carleton University, who first introduced me to Clint. Clint is a pastor in a Wesleyan Methodist church in Ottawa, and I assume that because of that Wesleyan connection, you will all feel your hearts strangely warmed this evening. And he is the executive director of the World Hope International Canada Relief and Development Organization. He also teaches on law and human rights at Carleton University. His academic interests are focused on international human rights as a site for our reflection on the intersection of faith, law, and politics in our world. And his first book on John Humphrey's came out just a few months ago from the University of Toronto Press. I'm just delighted you're here and you're going to be with us tomorrow for two lectures in Edmonton to open up this area, and it builds on some of the things we've been doing and many of the things we're going to be doing in the future. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Just before we get started, is my voice amplified? How about now? I'd like to thank Augustana College, the Chester Ronnie Center. Is it too loud? Rob, can you turn me down just a bit? How's that? It's okay? I'd like to thank Augustana College, the Chester Ronnie Center, for inviting me here this evening. I'd also like to express my appreciation to the Hendrickson family, for funding this annually. My theme is international human rights. So let me give you a rundown of what I want to do tonight. The first thing I want to do is briefly describe the situation of international human rights in the world today. Then, I want to talk about what I think are some of the really big problems and challenges facing human rights. Problems that are really anchored in the Enlightenment rationality that underwrites the mainstream view of human rights. And finally, I want to talk about what I think is a better way to think about human rights, which as it happens is the way that the draft or the Universal Declaration of Human Rights thought about. Let me begin with a story. It's a very old story. It's a sad story. Once upon a time, in ancient Greece, was a city. The city's name was Thebes. The king of Thebes died. Tragically, he left two sons. Two sons fought for the throne. In a pitched battle at the city gates, both sons died. There's a power vacuum. Into the power vacuum stepped a man, Creon by name. He seizes the throne of Thebes, and as his first act of power as king, he commands that one of the king's sons shall be given a royal burial, the burial of a hero. The other son, he commands, should be left before the city gates to be devoured by dogs and birds. The message that Creon is sending is clear. He holds power to exalt, power to debase. He's the king of Thebes! Don't you dare mess with Creon. But these dead brothers, they have a sister. Her name is Antigone. She quietly proceeds to give the burial rites for her disgraced brother in the field. She's covering his body with sand. She's discovered, arrested, brought before the king. Creon looks at this young woman. Cries, "What? You have dared contravene the king's command!" He sentences her to death by starvation. Antigone stands as she hears her sentence. She looks the king in the eye, and with a voice trembling with emotion, says these words, "That order to leave my brother's body to rot in the field did not come from God. Justice that dwells with the gods below knows no such law. I did not think your edict strong enough to overrule the unwritten, unalterable laws of God and heaven. They are not of yesterday or today, but everlasting. Though where they came from, none of us can tell. I suspect that we're no longer so certainly know what justice and mercy mean in a pluralistic international environment. It's just much easier to be practical and to focus on the technical or legal side of things. As a result, the contemporary person does not think about human rights, but from human rights. But if we peel off the Teflon coating of pragmatism and try to discern the contemporary understanding of human rights, what do we find? We find the Enlightenment, and more particularly the Enlightenment commitments to secularity and rationality. Louis Hankin, his former president of the American Society of International Law, put it plainly in 1998, I quote, "The human rights ideology is a fully secular and rational ideology whose very promise of success as a universal ideology, depends on its secularity and rationality. Now, I had the benefit of reading Henkin's whole article. I'll tell you what it means. Henkin means that rights are the product of the Enlightenment vision of humans as rational, volitional, and autonomous creatures. Our dignity resides in our capacity to govern our own lives. Human rights provide that freedom, whether they be civil and political rights or socioeconomic rights. For Henkin, rights are the result of objective and logical attention to the data in question, uncolored by any prior commitments to doctrine or theory. This rational approach to moral questions corresponds precisely to a rational approach to questions pertaining to the natural sciences, such as chemistry or biology. All honest persons, regardless of their other virtues or perspectives, looking at the same data, will arrive at an identical conclusion: the support and promotion of human rights to secure the largest degree of individual autonomy possible, so long as they adhere to a consistent method of inquiry and keep other considerations, such as religious traditions, off the table. So, we scratch human rights, discover the Enlightenment. What's wrong with that? Hannah Arendt's book, The Human Condition, is worth reading in that regard. I'll give you a praise. The trouble with modern life, according to Arendt, is the profound alienation we've experienced from the human condition, from the world, the earth. The superiority of contemplation over the active life which marked the ancients has been reversed. Moreover, mere labor oriented towards survival has supplanted politics within the realm of the active life. As a result, we've generally lost the capacity for true political action as well as contemplation. All that we have left is labor, working in order to survive. And this manifests in a corruption of political philosophy, the replacement of true contemplation with what Arendt called philosophies of life, in which the only good imaginable is biological survival. What does this mean practically? It means that the only political guidance such a philosophy offers us is the injunction to avoid suffering. Now, under this bleak view of modernity, human rights look like nothing more than an expression of this alienation, this reduction in human existence to the biologically vital, to surviving the present crisis, to avoiding suffering. Rights appear to be a technical way to efficiently dodge suffering toward the end of mere survival. And with this comes a brutal homogenization and leveling of human life, which technical efficiency harnessed toward the end of subsistence and the avoidance of suffering holds universal sway. Hello, globalization. Now, recalling the five fault lines we mentioned earlier, it's easy to see how the mainstream Enlightenment view of rights simply does not have theoretical depth to lead us through these tangled forests. Take the first impasse I mentioned, the complex web of tensions and affirmations that presently exist between human rights and traditional religions, such as Christianity, Islam, and so forth. If Arendt is right, and the Enlightenment has led us to the present situation of alienation from the world, where our response to problems is to fall back on technical solutions designed toward efficiency and survival, well, there's simply no hope of articulating a nuanced and meaningful relationship between traditional religions and human rights. And that, in my view, is the situation of human rights today on the international scene. Mortgaged to an Enlightenment vision of individual autonomy and supported by a view of rationality that's defined by its independence from tradition and faith, human rights have generated a huge international network of institutional supports and possess substantial rhetorical power as the most important international normative framework we have. But rights have also been frustrated by the difficulty of implementing them when it really counts, and the inability to respond effectively to the five challenges I mentioned earlier. In fact, human rights as a child of the Enlightenment seem to be part and parcel of the banality which Arendt identified with modernity, the loss of the capacity to engage in contemplation, and the orientation of public life toward a coarse utilitarianism. If the form of Enlightenment or form of rationality associated with the Enlightenment has led us to an impasse with regard to international human rights, we could ask, well, is there another way to conceive of human rights? And there is. Immanuel Kant is an interesting guy. He wrote an essay once. It's entitled, What is Enlightenment? And what he said always stuck with me. The Enlightenment has given all of us a command. And the command is this: think for yourself. I think most of us have grown up under that command. But people being people, we never quite think for ourselves, do we? We cluster into gangs, put on gang colors, define our turf, and defend that turf from incursions by other gangs. I've certainly seen that in the academy. And what we're seeing today is something like street gang battles regarding the meaning of human rights and even of rationality itself. A scholar named Alistair MacIntyre helped me understand this. In his 1988 Gifford Lectures, MacIntyre noted that contemporary moral inquiry is characterized by multiple understandings of what it means to be rational. There are not one, not two, but three different accounts of rationality out there today. And what's more, these accounts of rationality are incommensurate. They're incompatible with each other. What we mean by reason and what we mean by rationality depends on which gang we've joined. Now, we've already discussed the Enlightenment version of rationality and its associated view of rights. We could call that Kant's gang. Human rights go part and parcel with the Enlightenment vision of the free choosing and autonomous individual, and in large measure constitute the necessary conditions for the expression of Enlightenment rationality. And this is the biggest gang in the human rights world today. But there are rivals. The second gang we can associate with none other than Friedrich Nietzsche and his postmodern progeny. This version of rationality concerns itself with the construction of a subversive narrative which undermines all the central assumptions of the Enlightenment. Reason is really just an expression of power. From this perspective, Enlightenment rationality is just an elaborate stage play to cover up the violent imposition of one group's opinions upon another. Nietzsche's book, The Genealogy of Morals, is the perfect example of this form of rational inquiry. It's the third gang. The third gang is the one headed up by Pope Leo XIII. It's the Neo-Thomists. And with this gang, rational inquiry is grounded in a particular type of tradition, best expressed in the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas. Reason involves probing to the essences of things. Against Kant's gang, the Neo-Thomists insists that method is insufficient without piety, that a craft tradition is needed to guide inquiry, and that you need virtues to properly pursue wisdom, which is associated with friendship with God. Now, what does all this have to do with human rights today? Well, plenty. The post-war Human Rights Project reflects the profound confusion which marks contemporary moral inquiry. Following the rationality of the Enlightenment, human rights appears the progressive realization of universal reason in human affairs, implying at the same time a transcending of cultural particularities toward one homogeneous, rational civilization. And this, I believe, captures the mainstream view of human rights today. But if one looks at rights from under Nietzsche's covers, human rights appear as a veiled power play. The claim to universality made by international human rights is nothing less than covert domination. It's colonialism on the sneak. And under the aegis of neo-Thomism, human rights appear as the recapitulation of a venerable tradition which sees a universal normative standard based on the real, essential nature of humans under God. Just as one might expect, a survey of the literature on human rights reveals the presence of three gangs: those that affirm rights as a product of an abstract and disinterested reason, Kant's gang; those that regard rights as rationally groundless power masquerading as justice, Nietzsche's gang; and those that affirm rights as an outgrowth of St. Thomas's doctrine of natural law, Neo-Thomists. The biggest and strongest gang within contemporary human rights discourse, again, is Kant's gang. And when it comes to rights, Enlightenment rationality rules. Now, as for me, I do not find myself at home in any of these gangs. I agree in large measure with Arendt's criticisms of the Enlightenment. Grounding everything in a free, autonomous individual does not provide enough substance to sustain a rich public discourse. It inevitably reduces everything to a coarse utilitarianism. But Neo-Thomism, while intellectually rich and impressive, seems too rigid. Too rigid for our pluralistic context, too rigid to follow the contours of reality. And postmodernism, while an intriguing critical theory, seems pretty much useless for offering practical guidance. It's not rigid enough. So I feel a bit like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But worse, in this bed, the Neo-Thomist bed, is too hard. And this bed, the Nietzschean bed, was not hard enough. And this bed, the Enlightenment bed, is just banal. So is there no other way? I think there is. And I'd like to take the remainder of my time this evening to describing what I regard as the brightest hope for international human rights today. What we need to do, in my opinion, is to re-articulate the concepts bequeathed by the Enlightenment in a richer fashion, to open up fresh ways of understanding the reality in which we find ourselves. More specifically, the need of the hour is to recover humanité in the late modern age by plumbing the depths of the life philosophy and the resultant technical apparatus of international. You know, when Hannah Arendt gave her scathing critique of modernity in the human condition, she identified one philosopher in particular as the prime example of life philosophy in the 20th century, a philosopher named Henry Bergson. And I think that Henry Bergson is exactly the person we need to turn to in order to guide the human rights movement today. Now, let me explain this. Several years ago, in the attempt to understand human rights at a deeper level, I turned to a little-known but very significant figure in the post-war human rights movement. We've got his picture on my book. It's Dr. John Humphrey. Humphrey was a McGill Law School professor, and he was appointed head of the Secretariat for the UN's Human Rights Commission in 1947. And it was Humphrey who produced the first draft of what we now call the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Humphrey kept a private journal of his thoughts during his 10 1980s were locked safe, but then in the early 90s, his estate released his diaries. Now, these journals are a very interesting reading, because they tell us what Humphrey thought he was doing as he helped steer the Universal Declaration through the various UN committees to its final ratification in December 1948. So, what did Humphrey think he was doing? Well, the journals reveal that Humphrey saw the problems of the Enlightenment and the impersonal technical orientation that alienates and homogenizes and dehumanizes us. He rejected the standard Enlightenment view of human rights. But he was also uncomfortable with the views we've identified with Nietzsche and Pope Leo XIII. Humphrey saw that there was some kind of universal moral law which would serve to limit and guide relations between individuals and their governments. He saw the need for a universal language of mercy and justice as a necessity to world peace. He even located this in what he called Christian morality. But he was a man of his age. And a modern man that he was unable to accept the theological commitments of Neo-Thomism. So in short, Humphrey was a man without a game. In his perplexity, Humphrey stumbled across the writings of Henry Bergson. On Christmas Eve, 1948, Humphrey journaled. Bergson's Two Sources of Morality and Religion is perhaps one of the most important books I've ever read. In Bergson's writings, Bergson's philosophy, Humphrey had found another way to conceptualize international human rights, a way that avoided the Enlightenment problems that are identified, and yet was neither Nietzschean nor Thomistic. A fourth bed for Goldilocks, one that was just right. So, what did Bergson say that was so astonishing? If I was going to write a book called Bergson for Dummies, here's how it would go. Bergson's philosophy is predicated on a single insight. We exist in time and space, but we habitually submit time to space in order to facilitate analysis and control. Let me give you some examples. We take time and we transliterate it into spatial segments, seconds, minutes, hours, days. We can spatially represent on a clock face, on a calendar. But if you think about it, the flow of time is in reality not broken up into discrete segments. It's a flow. But we do this operation on time, spatializing it to make it measurable and capable of being controlled by humans. Likewise, and more importantly, we take thoughts, which are a flow, and we transliterate them into concepts and words. Words that we can put in books, fill our bookshelves with. Words that take up space. Habitually and consistently, we take the dynamic elements of our existence and we render them static, representing them in spatial form. However, careful attention to the details of our existence strongly suggests that life is not reducible to space or to matter. But should we attend carefully to our consciousness, as Bergson would say, penetrate our consciousness, it's clear that something is lost in the translation. Reality, as we experience it, is shot through with dynamism, with the great mysteries of birth and growth and decay and death, processes which are unmeasurable unless we translate them into spatial terms. But that translation distorts them. So when we speak of reality, we must acknowledge that there are really two interpenetrating realms. The realm of matter and the realm of spirit, of time. Matter is measurable, in large part controlled, the realm of time or of spirit, is dynamic, mysterious, largely uncontrollable. So in Bergson, we have an affirmation of the realm of spirit as distinct from matter, an affirmation of the penetration of spirit into matter, affirmations made not on the basis of any metaphysical speculation or theological commitment, but on the basis of reality as we experience it, which is to say, on an entirely modern basis. An interesting idea. Even mind-blowing if you think about it. I've often thought that you can understand Bergson better if you're a little bit drunk when you read him. But what has this got to do with international human rights? Well, in his final book, The Two Sources of Morality and Religion, the book that John Humphrey said was the most important thing he'd ever read, Bergson applied his insight to the question of justice. And he discovered two forms of justice, different in kind, but sharing a lexicon, using the same words. The first form of justice corresponds to matter, to space. And it's concerned with the survival of the group. It's the justice of what Bergson called the closed society, the society which seeks to maintain itself, to survive. And this form of justice is best expressed in abstract decrees. I'll give you an example. Perhaps, you know, when you were growing up, your mother sat you down on her knee and she began to teach you moral lessons. My mother did. I remember one. My mother told me, Clint, don't tell lies. And I never asked you why. You can get so much further ahead by the way. And she shook her head and she said, because if everybody lied, our community would fall apart. How could we live together? If everybody stole, how could we live together? And so we must not steal. We must not lie. And this first form of justice, Bergson called closed justice, the justice that the morality that's grounded in the survival of the community. Kind of parallels the instinct you see in social insects like bees. The second form of justice corresponds not to matter at all, not to survival, but to spirit. This other form of justice, of morality, is not concerned with mere survival of the group. It's universal. And it's oriented toward the absolute, or maybe better to say, it's an incarnation of the absolute. It's knowable through intuition. And it's best expressed not in impersonal decrees, but in the lives of great men and women who incarnate. I'll give you another example. I want each of you to pause now and call to mind the most generous person that you have ever met personally. Do this. Humor me. If you have their faces in your mind, the most generous person that you've ever met. Now, thinking about that person, your interactions with that person, was it simply that they were dutifully carrying out the injunction, do not steal? Perhaps putting a fence around that, being a little bit generous, and so preserving the community. Was it social obligation that motivated them? Or was there something more there? Something holy and joyful and alive that was bubbling out of them so they couldn't help but be generous? And when you were with them, didn't you become more generous too? That's what Bergson called open morality. And it's not grounded at all, it's rather suspended. It's suspended from something that's living and divine and sacred and dynamic. In a word, grace. So think of St. Francis preaching to the birds. Think of the founder of Hasidic Judaism, the Baal Shem Tov, the stories they tell about it. Think of Antigone, brave Antigone, standing before the king. Human rights, in Bergson's view, are at heart the latter kind of morality. They are open morality. They're the morality of the saints. But here's the problem. Here's the rub. Whenever you're dealing with open morality, it's incarnate. And you proceed to act on this vision of open morality as a community, you necessarily have to speak. And when you speak, you translate something dynamic and mysterious into spatial terms. And in particular, the act of writing things down in legal texts requires a translation from open morality back to closed morality. And the result is a gap. A gap between the legal text and the reality to which the text points. And while such texts are embraced, they're frankly regarded as limited, provisional, and ultimately unsatisfactory. The text, as a technical expression of the transcendent reality, obscures even as it reveals. And reflection on the bare text leads to paradoxes. While examples of such texts include the Sermon on the Mount, even the Ten Commandments. And the result is that on the one hand, the Universal Declaration of Rights is a pointer to great moral leaders, not likely but the many self-sacrificing moral heroes which the Second World War revealed. And as such, represents a call to imitate these great souls. But on the other hand, the Declaration partakes of closed justice, concerns itself with survival of the world through adherence to the rules. Human rights are best understood in terms of this dialectic, this back and forth between open and closed morality, between static and dynamic elements of our existence, between the survival of the community, the world community, and friendship, something transcendent. John Humphrey, the drafter of the Declaration, loved Bergson's view of human rights, because it provided a superstructure in which to place human rights, a kind of semantic framework. It didn't provide a foundation for rights in the same way that neo-Thomism does. It does not ground fluctuating human laws in firm, bedrock, eternal, static truth. No. On the contrary, it's a view of rights that's dynamic and indeterminate, which regards rights in terms of the dialectic interplay between matter and spirit. To better distinguish this from neo-Thomism, I found it helpful to position Bergson in terms of the grand old debate between Eastern and Western versions of the Christian faith. Now usually, and especially if you've read Leo Strauss and his disciples, we think of the Western philosophical heritage in terms of a great rupture between the ancients and the moderns. But it's also possible to view this heritage in terms of a great divide between Eastern and Western Christianity. The two branches developed different ways of understanding the Christian faith and indeed different ways of thinking. Through the seven ecumenical councils, these two ways were held together in a creative tension, but by the 11th century, they had really gone their separate ways. And this resulted in an eclipse of the Eastern way in favor of the Western way, at least in the West. And I believe that this great eclipse, the loss of the creative tension between East and West, is what has in large measure led us to the modern impasse that Arendt described. But it also leads me to suspect that the Greek patristics, one of the great tectonic plates of Western civilization, holds potential as a source for renewing modernity, and certainly renewing human rights today. So, to help us distinguish a Bergsonian view of rights from Neo-Thomism, what's the difference between the Greek East and the Latin West? Well, there's three, in my view. The first fundamental difference is found in the status of matter. Both East and West distinguish spirit from matter. Both rank spirit above matter and see an antagonism between spirit and matter. But the Latins, the West, typically assert a greater distance between the two than the Greeks. While the Latins emphasize the separation between spirit and matter, between God and the world, the Greeks tend to regard matter or physicality more positively, seeing a participation of matter and spirit which qualifies the antagonism, which even regards matter as profoundly complicit in the life of the spirit. Bergson's account of the spirit-matter relationship is very Greek. While he continually asserts the resistance of matter to spirit, he ultimately regards matter as the arena in which spirit is being revealed. The second difference is found in the expectations regarding human knowledge. While both East and West affirm rationality, the Greeks ultimately submit this rationality to an immediate and noetic knowledge of the transcendent. Latin thought is typically disparaged as such noetic knowledge, shunted its claims of this type to another category called mysticism. Latin knowledge is rational knowledge, which can only know the transcendent by analogy or as a hypothetical. Bergson, with his intuition of spirit, and his insistence that this is not an escape from consciousness, but rather a penetration into consciousness, that does not disqualify intellect, but rather works with and above intellect, is Greek par excellence. The third basic difference between the Greeks and the Latins is the status of human nature. Based on a distinction between God's essence and God's energies, which was drawn to apprehend the incarnation, the East regards human nature as profoundly dynamic. The West, with its emphasis on God's essence, regards human nature as primarily static. Again, it's obvious that Bergson favors the Greeks on this question. Reality for Bergson consists of both dynamic and static elements, but humans for Bergson are ultimately dynamic beings. This dynamism is developed in the two sources in terms that are very close to the classic Greek theme of theosis. Bergson tells us that human completion requires, quote, getting back to God, and that the universe is, again a quote, a machine for the making of gods, and even points to Jesus as the chief example of human perfection. Well, the correspondence between Bergson and Greek theology, particularly the points where Greek and Latin perspectives divide, is striking. And this is not to say that Bergson should be regarded as an orthodox theologian. There's no evidence books that he's working from an overtly Byzantine theological framework. But what I want to affirm is, first of all, that Bergson represents a contrapuntal strain within the history of Western philosophy, which finds its most differentiated explication in the tension between Greek and Latin theology. Secondly, that his vision of human rights is not capable of being subsumed under Neo-Thomism. And thirdly, that this contrapuntal strain via John Humphrey has entered the contemporary milieu via the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So let me sum all this up for you. Bergson penetrates to the depths of modernity, produces a life philosophy, and there discovers, on entirely modern terms, a basis to reconstruct philosophy along the classical orientation, the attunement of the soul to the real order of the cosmos. Particularly, it seems to me that Bergson lays a foundation for the recovery of what Plato called phronesis, or practical judgment, over against the technicality, which is the fruit of the modern replacement of judgment with the method. Human rights, in Humphrey's view, affirm human dignity based on the uniquely human capacity for relationship with the divine. And thus we get a kind of a natural law, but not one constructed on a metaphysical human essence. Rather, it's constructed on an experiential dynamic, that of the experience of reality and the translation of this experience into rules. So, when the rubber hits the road, what practical guidance does this theory of international human rights offer us? Well, every theory of rights has limits. This one's definitely no cure-all. But I think the strongly dialectical character of this view of international rights does some very good things for us. Let me cite just two. First of all, this view of rights opens up conversations about the nature and destiny of human beings. It lifts us out of the emergency mode pragmatism that usually conditions our discussions of human rights. It moves human rights out of the realm of the purely technical, legal considerations, and allows for philosophical anthropology to emerge in public discourse. In addition, I think that this mode of human rights opens up some very interesting conversations between the human rights community and traditional religious communities. Under the standard Enlightenment view of human rights, the approach is to come to a venerable tradition, such as Christianity or Islam or Hinduism, and demand that such religious societies should set their religion aside as irrational and conform to human rights norms. The message you get from the human rights community is, get with the program, you religious people. Now, the response, I think particularly of the Islamic societies, the response is lukewarm at best. But should the human rights community come to a religion, describe their vision of human rights as a provisional expression of mercy and justice for pluralistic settings, a product of a dialectic between open and closed moralities, between matter and spirit, between the unspeakable, apophatic experience of encountering a saint, and the necessities of survival. And then ask, you Muslims, you Christians, you Hindus, tell us about your vision for mercy and justice within your religious tradition. Tell us how you negotiate the tension between spirit and matter, between the heavens and the earth. Well, I think you're into a very different kind of conversation. And frankly, a much more hopeful one in the long term. But it's a conversation that can only happen if human rights are reconceived in the way the drafter of the Universal Declaration envisioned, as the provisional output of a dialectic between the material and spiritual aspects of our existence. Now, you may say to me, well, Dr. Curl, isn't that a little bit ambitious? I mean, isn't the form of secularism we have out there pretty strong? Such that you go to the world and you tell them about Bergson and Humphrey and you talk in such glowing terms about matter and spirit, and won't they just tune you out? Regard you as incoherent? And here, I think, is where religious communities come in. Because what's really needed in the world today is for us to re-engage at a deep level the human condition and to overcome the alienation that Hannah Arendt described. I think what's really needed is for us to begin to do public philosophical anthropology, to ask the big questions publicly again. I think human rights are the most ideal site to do that. So how do we develop a rich texture, philosophical culture around human rights? This is where religious communities come in. I think religious communities are perhaps the only groups in the international community today who can dialogue with the human rights community, who can push them and allow them to push us. And that in talking in these ways, I think we can go somewhere. And the great thing about John Humphrey and Henry Bergson is they give us both this historical foothold and a language in which to have such a conversation.
Yes. I'm interested in your practical application, how you see this dialogue actually happening.
Yeah.
I think it's not your vision, but how you actually get these groups of people to engage in the community.
Yeah, the question was with regards to an application, she's the questioner commented that she thinks I'm onto something, but how practically speaking do we get these two groups to actually dialogue in a meaningful way?
Creating this new energy, this new place.
Creating new energy and sort of beginning to work on retexturing the culture of human rights. And that's a great question. I think it happens through conflict, to be honest. I think that that's how it initially happens, you know? I think it happens in places like Sudan, where we have these genocides going on, and the human rights community is quite rightly up in arms, right? But we can't seem to get anywhere, because the particular form of this Islam that we have in Sudan is so bifurcated that the choices in Islamic society in Sudan are, you know, be a faithful Muslim or apostatize and accept human rights. I mean, this is the choice that every citizen has. It's terrible. Right? So you have sort of an extreme form of Islam there. It's creating all kinds of human rights problems. You have a conflict. I think it's out of that kind of situation and the necessity of actually trying to find a workable solution there that these kind of conversations can happen. So it's a painful way to go. I think that's, you know, how things change. Something I read once in one of George Grant's books, he just sort of threw in a sidebar comment. I mean, how does change happen historically? Change happens when people experience injustice. That seems to be the truth. If enough people experience injustice under the present situation, then things change. We begin to talk. And I think that experiencing injustice, both as religious communities and as human rights communities, at the hands of religion, is sort of how things change.
Yep. If I can give a footnote to that,
sure.
Just about the Sudan one. I heard Roland Miller a while back. Roland Miller's lecture here, stood. And he was a missionary in India for a long time, and also been pulled into, he's an expert on Islam. He was in Sudan some years ago, invited there by the agency, because there were about 20 churches and 20 mosques that had been burned in several villages. And he described how after that, the exhaustion of that, there were several people who were able to pull together a dozen Christian leaders and a dozen Muslim leaders into a room and to have them speak to each other about how the other was dreadful, which they did in a pretty fulsome way. And then they took a break, and he said the Muslim gentleman went and sat in a circle over there, the Christians went to another room. But he, being, what do you call him? He's Bob. He's a magnificent Muslim scholar, a deeply devout Christian, but he dwells in both those worlds. He went over after a time, not immediately, but after a time, and asked if he could sit in the circle of Muslim leaders. And so they made room for him, and he sat and listened. After a time, listening, as they talked about how there was a need to implement a very serious Sharia. It was the only source of their salvation, one of your examples, and in the Muslim form of Neoplatonism. He listened for a time, and then he asked if he could speak. He said, "Brothers, can I just say a few words?" So they said, "Sure." So he began to reflect on the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And he pointed out to them that the Prophet had lived his whole life in Medina and Mecca. His whole life, the prophet, without the benefit of Sharia. There was a collective gasp. They knew he was right. He spoke something they didn't know they knew. So my point is to build on your comments. Someone like Roland Miller goes into that setting not with the usual hard position on one side or the other, ready for battle. He goes in with knowledge of who he's talking to, a deep interest in trying to find avenues of conversation, and a willingness to live with ambiguity.
When the Muslims and the Christians came to Jerusalem,
Saladin had a way of making peace. Yes. Did you want to continue that?
What was his approach?
I can't say at this point. Do you know?
Well, it's what he meant with what David was saying about the Christian. They were wrote in Muslims.
Right. Yeah. I think there's a way to go there.
It wasn't the Christians. It was the Muslims.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what Islam means, peace, doesn't it? Sure, it does. I'll tell you a story. It's a good question, right? I'm teaching a course right now at Carleton University, Controversies in Rights Theory. And we did one class, we devoted it to the tensions and affirmations between human rights and religions. And I got the students to read three articles. The first article was the one I cited by Louis Hankin, which says that human rights were a secular and rational ideology and must remain so. And the more we could differentiate them from any kind of traditional religion, the better. The second article was by a scholar named William Perry. William Perry says that what human rights really mean is that every human being is sacred. And there's no way to make sense of that statement outside of a theological or religious framework. So human rights, to make sense of them, you have to appeal to theology. Now, the students were, it was amazing because, two-thirds of the students were secular. But one-third of them were religious, whether they're Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, right? Typical university class. So first we did the Louis Hankin article about secularity, right? And we talked about it, it was passionate debate on both sides. And then I asked the question, we were done the article, those of you who are religious and who are willing to self-identify as such, how many of you were deeply offended by this article? All the hands went up. You should have seen the faces of the other students. Really? We discussed the William Perry article, the one that talked about human rights being essentially a religious commitment. Again, passionate debate on both sides. We're done that article. I asked the students, those of you who don't identify with any religion, how many of you were actually offended by this article? And it went up all over the class. And those religious people were good.
But you wouldn't be offended,
right? And so this learning, this experience of conflict, right? But also an awareness of the other. And then we read a third article written by a guy named Abdullahi Anaim, who talked about the necessity of, much of the guy said, of a conversation between religious communities and human rights, and retexturing the concept of secularity, moving it from an ideology to a practice, things like this. And all of a sudden, the class grasped onto what Anaim who, by the way, is from Sudan, what Anahi was saying in a whole new way. In a way I wish they could have, without the awareness of how offensive their position was to the other. So I think conflict, that kind of conflict, prepares the soil for the kind of understanding that David was talking about. But it's a good question. Again, we're talking about processes that may take a long time. You know, this isn't the kind of thing you figure out in 3 months. Yes?
Your comment about observing Grant that when people feel injustice, then change happens. And I can think of the context of a very powerful country, the United States, whose government has decided people in Guantanamo Bay totally outside any legal or rights framework. And yet, presumably, there's really not much dialogue or not a lot of potential for questioning that approach or dialogue.
Yeah, at least not yet. Although, I mean, the question is with regard to Guantanamo Bay. U.S.'s disregard for human rights. And the comment was that, well, there's people experiencing injustice. We don't see any kind of meaningful dialogue coming out of that situation. Does that capture your comment? And you're quite right. Although I think, give it some time. I mean, I'm certainly hearing a lot of comments on the Canadian side about that. You know, we're hearing comments from the Red Cross on that. I mean, certainly people are trying to start a dialogue about this, and we're reading about it in newspapers. I mean, here we are talking about it. That's something. So perhaps there is some dialogue there yet. But you're right. I mean, as we know, I mean, hegemony is a real force. Right, and to have a proper dialogue, we do have to have an equality of power. And it's one of the conditions for a proper dialogue. Jürgen Habermas talks at length about the conditions, the formal conditions required to have sort of a dialogical event happening. And I'm certain it's not good. Yes?
You just do have an amazing amount, but there are, in fact, Republican judges who are questioning their own government, and that group of Republicans can say, well, that is not my America, whatever version of America they put on it. And so there are actually, I mean, in the last quite a few articles by now that exactly use that, you know, righteousness or whatever, have moved into no space outside of any legal framework, any protected framework. So they are rethinking, well, when does the government get way beyond what in fact is this founding inspiration, you know, whatever. So that actually is also happening in the States.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.